Hello and welcome to the CZU podcast episode for the Czech Researchers Night. My name is Ondra and my guest is the Emeritus Professor in Tropical Agronomy and Ethnobotany, originally from the Faculty of Bioscience Engineering at Ghent University and current Dean of the Faculty of Tropical Agrisciences, Professor Patrick van Damme. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, introducing you takes some time, as we just heard. So if you were supposed to describe or introduce yourself using only, let's say, 3 or 5 words, what would you say?
I would say ethnobotany. I would say tropical / subtropical agriculture. I would say microfinance. I would say sustainable development. I would say biodiversity. Mm-hmm.
Well, the topic of our interview is no time to lose to address the climate change. However, before we jump into this topic, I should specify that you are the first dean in the history of Czech University of Life Sciences who is not Czech. Is it an advantage or disadvantage?
Personally, I would think it's an advantage.
Huh. In what way?
Well, when someone would be mad at me, I wouldn't necessarily understand what he or she would be saying. Joking. No, I think it's always good to bring an outsider perspective to a certain situation. In my former life, I would say I was always happy when there was an outside evaluation. It's much more easy to accept the view of someone who has no direct links with the organization or with your own family or whatever you are linked to. So this outsider perspective, I think, is interesting. The downside may be that it will take me some time to get accustomed to local legal aspects, local customs. Culture is okay. I mean, it's different, but I have already seen that we have or that we share the same kind of humor up to a certain level. So there's always pros and cons, of course, but for the time being, I'm still quite happy. So
You've been a part of Faculty of Tropical Agrosciences for some time already.
Yeah. So I was officially appointed as a professor here in July 2012. Mm-hmm. But of course, the kind of interactions I had since then are different from what I have now as a dean.
Yeah, of course, of course.
Also, in the faculty as such, we normally communicate in English. Whereas at the university level, most of the communication also with the colleagues or the colleagues amongst themselves is in Czech. So that's a bit of a learning process, I would say. Yeah. Mm.
Well, I presume you were interested in nature from your very childhood, because in the interview for CZU webpage, you said, quoting, "When I was 12, I wanted to go abroad, make documentaries about nature, like David Attenborough," mm-hmm. end of quotes. So why aren't you a famous documentarist? Did you change your plan?
Well, I had this idea when I was 12. And then when I was 18, I was about to go to university. But I really had no clue what I would take as a subject. I mean, I had a broad interest. But then I remembered my idea of at least going abroad. And so abroad would be the tropics. That was what was in my mind. Attenborough, the movies I saw, the documentaries, they were in Latin America. I can still see the wild animals there roaming around in the Amazon. And so then I was thinking, how will I get there? And with my interest in nature, there was maybe two options. It was either biology or agronomy. And then to be realistic, I thought probably I'll get out faster when I do agronomy than with biology. And I might end up a teacher with biology. So I took agronomy and within, I think after 18 days after graduating, I was in Nigeria. So, and then of course you go on the path of research. I started after Nigeria working for FAO, but I had my interest still and I was taking lots of pictures. Mainly flowers, but in Senegal where I was stationed, also lots of birds. I was like living almost in the middle of the desert, and it was in an irrigated environment. And so all the birds that flew past when they were tracking north or going south, they stopped there. And so it was a very nice environment. But then after that, I completely went into research, but still I kept this idea. So at least there is one documentary featuring me with the work I did in Ecuador. So that was at least something, but I didn't film myself. But in 2 days' time, I go to Senegal, and we are three, and one of the three, he's a professional cameraman. So we will again do some shots and things. Yeah.
Well, in the same interview, you also stated that we have to find ways to push this, to be more present in the media, make ourselves heard. Now, having your David Attenborough way in mind, it seems to me you put a great emphasis on the PR side of your job. Is it so?
Yeah, yeah. I think that it's maybe improving, but until recently, I think that by many people, universities were seen as like ivory towers because most of the academics, they stayed secluded. They didn't inform the public. And if they did inform, it was through scientific articles that normally are too highbrow.
Too high.
So, and I think this is a mistake. And I know that most of my colleagues, they find it difficult to provide laymen with a simple message on maybe a complicated issue. But still, they should do it. And I think if you see now the divide between what science knows and what politicians do and decide, there's still a broad gap.
Yeah.
COVID
is
an interesting case. You have the virologists that maybe pretend or have the knowledge. But then before politicians take the right decisions or take the next step, it takes quite some time.
Yeah, yeah.
In Belgium, we had a minister of health who was herself a medical doctor. And even she pretended that she had no clue when the COVID started. She had virology in her curriculum when she took classes. I mean, and so there was still this fear that she would not well understand or misinterpret what was being said. And then, so we can only like close the gap there by communicating, by being open about what we do. So that's why emphasize the PR side of our
Is it
mandate.
Maybe another reason why sometimes public has difficulties with trusting the scientist? Is it because scientists are like closed in one room and they don't share their...
In a way, I know colleagues who pretend that you can never convey a scientific message without using difficult words. If you have this attitude, then of course nobody will understand you.
Yeah.
But I think that the public has problems with us sometimes because we are not necessarily speaking in one voice. Take climate change, take the global warming.
Yeah.
There are still, it's a very small group, there are still scientists.
But the smaller it is, the more you can hear it.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Well, there have been studies, and there is an interesting little documentary where this journalist, he's sitting in a room with a negationist, the one who denies that there is global warming, and that it is, if there is warming, then it's not man-made. So he's one-to-one with the journalist. And then the journalist says, but in effect, what we have here, we have one representative of a very small community. Now, I have invited the people who claim that global warming is indeed man-made and in come 99 persons. And that's what you get. I mean, this one person gets the voice, gets an interest from a journalist in a program, but he's a minority, an absolute minority. So by having the 99 others there, then you see as a public, hopefully you understand that indeed the majority, and they are right, claims that global warming comes from human activity, full stop. And so I think the message should be much clearer. And there should always be the caveat that when someone is opposing something, he or she has a right to that, if the arguments are okay. But it should also be put in perspective.
Yeah.
You should say, well, okay, but this is people, this is a minority voice, absolute minority voice. Mm-hmm.
Is it the role of the media to say that this is just a minority, but we still have to give it some space?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
To put it in political terms, we have some problems with nationalistic parties. We've had it for almost 30 years in Belgium. There was a ban on politicians belonging to that party mm-hmm. in the beginning. And now gradually they are allowed to voice their opinion, but mm-hmm. each time there is some framing. I mean, you are belonging to that party, okay?
Yeah.
Everyone knows it now. We discuss. We are opposing your view sometimes, even as journalists. They sometimes take a position which is not always okay, maybe. But I think everyone is allowed to his or her opinion, I repeat. Mm. But you should frame it, you should put it in perspective. Yeah.
The PR is currently done mostly via the social media. How about you personally? Are you active on social media? I'm not going to ask about TikTokers, obviously, but how about Twitter?
No, I've never done that. I think it's like sound bites. Eh? If you have a message and you have only 140 characters, mm-hmm. now it's doubled. So
now it's 280, yeah?
Yeah, but still, I think that, well, look, you can have a sound bite say that global warming is man-made.
Yeah.
That's only 25
yeah.
characters, presumably. But, and I think now it's accepted, it's an acceptable message. Mm-hmm. But this is like after years of everyone like claiming it and proving it. And
yeah.
But if it's like a new kind of issue, then you don't get there with 280 characters. Mm. Also, I think it's often very easy to start shouting at one another.
Yeah.
Through these, yeah.
Everybody's anonymous if they yeah. want to.
And also with the fakers and that whole army of... There's whole batteries of people on Facebook and
yeah.
Twitter who are not live persons, and then there's something behind it that's not kosher. Mm-hmm. So no, I'm not interested.
So you're saying it doesn't worth the effort?
No, I think that you should use it. And I mean, we discussed this also here in the faculty. I think you have to make a distinction between it's a means of communication,
mm-hmm.
so communicating, informing. And it's another thing to really take a position,
yeah.
like a political one or something, or defending a cause.
Mm.
And that's where it becomes a bit dicey. No one can be against the fact that you will announce that there is a film festival next mm-hmm, month.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, sure.
Some will say boo with that kind of subject. No, I mean, but the chances are slim there. So, but no, I've never done that. And yeah. It's only since this year that I have my first mobile phone. So I never had a phone either. So, I mean...
the good thing is it's not going to interrupt our interview.
No.
Okay, so now let us get back to the main topic of this interview, which is no time to lose to address the climate change. If I may quote again, but maybe this time from the Bill Gates book, How to Avoid a Climate Disaster. If the emissions continue to grow rapidly, then in the half of this century, the climate change will kill like COVID-19. And by the year 2100, it will be 5 times more deadly. End of quotes. That sounds like a very, very difficult future laying ahead of us, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. The thing is, the problem as such is intangible. It's immaterial. Well, you can argue that COVID is not visible either, but yeah, if the person next to you starts coughing and 2 days later he's dead, well, that's a clear message.
Yeah.
Here, it's a longer-term process. During this summer in Belgium, I know the Belgian figures a bit, we returned to normal death rates. In Belgium... on a normal day, there's 300 people dying.
Mm. It's basically the same in Czech Republic.
Yeah, because we have the same numbers. Yep. But during summer, we had a heat wave. And then you see that pop, the figures go up again.
Mm-hmm.
So older people, and that's been documented as well, the death rates amongst older people are higher on very warm days. and it's from heart failure and it's this and that.
Yeah.
But of course, those people are not necessarily on Twitter or are not visible, that visible. Sometimes it's lonely people living alone in their house or something. But still, it's good that it is documented and that it's amongst the talk of the day. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But so overall, the problem, maybe it's also, most of the people hit at this moment by climate change, by global warming, are living in the South. Mm-hmm. Also, and that's been documented in Northern America, the western part, in Oregon, they had temperatures going up 46 in shade.
Mm-hmm.
And they also had lots of people die, but the people who died were poor. Because the rich people, they have better houses and they have airco.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't necessarily hit those who take the decisions. It hits, again, the other half, the poor half of the population.
Yeah. Yeah.
And those have no voice. They don't go to vote.
Mm-hmm.
If they protest, they are quickly taken in and into jail. So it's a bit of a problem to make it visible and to convince people that something mm-hmm. invisible will claim more and more deaths if it continues like it is doing now.
Yeah. Is it also the reason why the topic is no time to lose? Is it really now, let's say, the last chance to do something about it?
It depends on the day of the week that you ask me the question, because sometimes I'm purely optimistic and on another day it will be more pessimistic. Maybe today I'm a bit more pessimistic. I would tend to think that it's maybe already too late, mm-hmm. especially in certain areas of the world. But that being said, I think we still have to try to do our best to at least slow down mm-hmm. the process, try and come up with measures that may reduce the rate at which temperatures go up. The linked problems like of disappearing or dwindling biodiversity can also be addressed, but maybe mm-hmm. like for the oceans and the barrier reefs and all that, it's too late, I don't know. On the positive side, you can say that, or you could say that nature is quite resilient.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved in following a bit the debate on palm oil, and so on oil palm cultivation and the negative impact it has on animal life. So it's the orangutan that stands out, but mm-hmm. there is also the Sumatra tiger. So I saw predictions of 2017 where they claimed that by 2021, mm-hmm. this year, there would be no Sumatra tiger left. The good news is that the numbers have not gone down. So mm-hmm. they're still at the number they had 3 years ago. However, of course, it's a very small population of maybe 1,500, mm-hmm. which is, well, it's at the limit of being a viable population. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there are a number of problems we must address when we want to fight the climate change. For example, how we make and use the electricity, how do we produce what we produce, how shall we transport goods and people around the globe. But the main topic for you out of this list is probably desertification and land degradation. What is the state of the earth concerning these two factors?
You have maybe two different issues here, maybe more even. To start with land degradation, there is a clear human impact mm-hmm. on the quality of land. There's a lot of mismanagement. The clearest, the most obvious, presumably, are the forest fires. And you have these even on the equator. So you have forest fires in Brazil. Mm-hmm. Since Bolsonaro is there, it's even worse.
Yeah.
You have those in Indonesia for oil palm cultivation. So that's a direct impact of a mismanagement by man of the soil, the land resource.
Mm-hmm.
On top of that, there is already the climate change effect that brings about longer drought periods or storms, heavy rain events, but when it rains heavily, then most of the rain will flow down into the sea without penetrating into the soil. And of course, the climate change is also man-induced. But so desertification is linked to the land degradation because, according to the definition, desertification is the process whereby land will produce less and less for whatever reason. So they are both linked. Now, of course, the continent where it is maybe most obvious, because it's the continent that, relatively speaking, has the highest surface area that suffers from a long dry period, is Africa. You have the big Sahara, and then in the south you have the Namib Desert and Kalahari, which are still quite green, but still. And so, of course, around those you have savannas, and those savannas have a tendency of expanding into the tropical forest that is around the equator. And it expands because of the combined effect of rising temperatures, decreasing rainfall, and then man-induced mishaps. So that's been documented. And of course, you are all much younger, but I went through the whole process. It started to become visible in 72, 73, when there was the first long, big drought in Africa. And so lots of people died and lots of cattle died. Now, cattle is like the livelihood for most people in the savanna areas. The reaction was to dig wells, to take water from the soil, which aggravated the situation because the water levels went down and the trees were unable to survive. So the second event was 82-83. And that was when Bob Geldof started singing and when we had the first Live Aid. So the drought and problematic became obvious 50 years ago, say, in 72. And it was only after that that climatologists started gathering data and blah, 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 and that they started to see that there were trends and that regions became indeed drier by the year or by the decade. And only then people started reflecting on how could we maybe stem this rate? How can we solve the problem or address before solving it, the problem? So it takes quite some time, and it has been there for a long time. Yeah. And in the meantime, of course, in 72, I don't know how many, maybe there were 400 million Africans, but now they are 1.2, 1.5. Billion. So population numbers have risen. And so the problematic as such becomes worse and worse because of the population density.
And how can the research help with this problem? And what has been achieved, actually?
Well, basically, the way I try to deal or help deal with it is to look at, indeed, what can you do on the ground, literally. In a way, you can try to maybe to revert to ancient methods, because people know how to address. In most cases, local people know how to address these problems. Of course, if they become too big, then there might be the issue of not having enough monetary means to address those problems. But you can try, first of all, to analyze, discuss with the people, and then to see what you can do at the local level. What I'm doing there is helping out with trying to have people replant using local tree shrub species, also have them collect seeds of herbs and grasses that are interesting for their animals. And then with the trees that you bring back to their environment, because they make the choice, they will choose trees that have more than one use. So for us, maybe it's interesting to have an area planted with trees because you are regreening the environment. Yeah. For them, it's regreening with interesting species. So that's where the ethnobotanist comes in and can help out. And then you can also maybe try to convey some messages on better management of the environment, taking what they know, the techniques that they have been using before that maybe they lost because we introduced new techniques, bring those back and then match with scientific findings because we may understand better how nature works now and try to bring in that knowledge and match that with what they know. I think it's not rocket science. It has to be done. It has to be brought to the people. And so I worked quite a long time already. I have been working in the UN environment. And there is also something called the CG. So there is a group of international research institutes that focus on food plants. Now, each time I did something for them, they asked me to find and to emphasize innovative techniques. Mm-hmm. And I always thought, bollocks, I mean, if you would start using the knowledge that you gathered over these decades and brought that to the people, you would already have solved a lot. I always presented my students with the same example. I started in Senegal in 1882, and I was in extension, so I had to work with tomato-growing farmers. I had to try to improve their production, their yield. Now, I'm from the city. I never saw a tomato plant before I started doing that. So I thought, if you want to be serious, Vandamme, you really have to do it yourself. So I had 1 hectare of tomatoes, and I was growing them as they were growing them, and as they were supposed to grow them, maybe, because sometimes there's a whole technical thing behind it. And I was doing that. Now, I had 120 tons per hectare, which is quite okay. They had, it was 12.5, but they had 12 tons per hectare. Mm-hmm. That's 10% of what I had.
Yeah.
So then you start reflecting. It's the same variety. It's the same water because it was the same field. I took like 1 hectare in that environment. The same soil, the same sun, same fertilizer, same pests and diseases.
Everything was the same, basically. Yeah.
And then you wonder, I harvested every week.
Uh-huh.
And they harvested over a period where they could have harvested that lasted like 3 to 4 months. Maybe they 2 or 3 times. Meaning that in between 2 harvest runs, there was more than a month.
Yeah.
And 90% of the tomatoes had rotten. So it doesn't call for rocket science to go and explain.
Does it call for a common sense?
It calls, the reason why they did not harvest more was that they thought, they found that they didn't get enough money for it. So why bother? You know, okay, yeah, we have some tomatoes. And okay, we need some money, but all that effort. So they were not motivated.
Okay, so it's a lack of motivation.
Yeah. But so it's not technical.
Yeah.
It's socioeconomic.
Yeah.
It's knowing their mentality, so the social part. And it's economic, it's the financial part. It's what motivates people. At the end of the day, it's money.
Yeah.
Wherever they are. Now, the good news is I was back 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Some other organization had asked me to go to that same area. It was the village next to the one where I had been living, to give additional training and advice on tomato and onion growing there. And so the good news is that their current yield is up to 40 or 50 tons. So over like 40 years, they have added 30 to 40 tons per hectare, which is quite okay.
Yeah.
It's still not what it could be.
Mm-hmm.
But well, I mean, there's always a difference between what you can get and obtain under scientific or scientifically managed environment and what you really, what you get in real life, I would say. So, but I think that they will improve. And the people I was working with then, and that was I was giving advice to, they were really, they were positive and they really wanted to learn more. And so I think they will progress. So mutatis mutandis, you can say now for the climate change, for desertification, it's a bit of the same. For me, I told FAO, you are reforesting, but the problem of your project is that you are working with foresters.
Exactly. That's why I want to ask, how difficult is to teach the local people to do something differently that they want to do? As you said, it's not about the technical equipment, or maybe partially, but it's also mostly about the motivation.
Yeah.
How difficult it is to motivate people?
Well, for me, it's not not that difficult.
Yeah.
But you have to take your time.
Mm-hmm.
And you have... I tell my students, you know, Schumacher, he said, small is beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I always tell my students, slow is beautiful. Take mm-hmm. your time. Yeah. So go and sit with the people. What's your problem? The problem will not be climate change.
Mm-hmm.
It will not be desertification. It will be we have no food for our children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you start with discussing that. How can we address that?
Yeah.
At the same time, you bring in the idea of maybe having trees there, because the tree provides shade.
Mm-hmm.
In the shade, temperature is lower, and you can grow some vegetables, everybody happy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah? Mm-hmm.
But you take your time. And so after, if it takes 2 years, it takes 2 years. If they are not convinced, then you say, okay, bye-bye.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go to the next village and try my luck there. So you have to take your time, and then you build up, and it's also small. So you have to work with all of them, each village, almost, spot-wise.
So that they can inspire each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that there is a spillover. So mm-hmm. that a good example may serve as a good example and inspire others to do the same.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have to take your time. One of the keywords characterizing me, I said, was microfinance.
Mm-hmm.
When I was working in Togo, I started some what is called cereal banks. You motivate people to save some mm-hmm. at harvest, to store it so that they can use it during the next growing season when normally there's not enough seeds, food left.
Yeah.
They very quickly understood. And I started in 86.
Mm-hmm.
And we asked them to bring 1 kilo per person.
Mm-hmm.
They brought that.
How much do they get now?
Normally, so the production at family level was like 1,000, 1,500. So
mm-hmm.
1 kilo doesn't mean much. They quickly understood that. So the second year, we asked them to maybe bring 5 kilo.
Yeah.
5 out of 1,000 is still infinite. And we stayed with the 5. And then the idea was, okay, I've had enough in my storeroom, so I don't need it during the difficult mm-hmm, period, mm-hmm. but you need it. So, okay, you can take. And then you pay me back at your harvest, but with an interest. And so we saw very quickly that the stored amounts were increasing. And after 5 years, the people who had told me before
mm-hmm.
that they were hungry during the growing period, they told me we are no longer hungry. But we want to continue with the initiative.
Yeah.
Started in 86. Also, I went back 5 years ago. Out of those cereal banks grew a formal bank mm-hmm. where you can put your savings and you can obtain a credit that has more than 300 employees
mm-hmm.
and which is now catering for the whole area. So it started with 1 kilo and it ended up with billions in their local currency.
Mm-hmm.
It was slow in the beginning, but the time that you soi-disant lose, because some people will die during the first years because you were not able to address their problem, you will recuperate very quickly when mm-hmm. once the whole system starts working.
Yeah.
In the current approach where foresters plant trees and are not interested in the people who planted the trees, you will see that they plant the tree on the first rainy period. The year after that, they come back and they see, oh, there's no tree left. Oh, let's plant again. So they will go up, down, mm-hmm. and it will never change.
Yeah.
So you have really to respect the fact that it's about people planting trees. So you have to sit with them. And the money that you spend on planting trees, even now, using the gimmicks like in China, you bring in the drone that will sow the seed for you. Easy. The Chinese love all these new techniques.
Yeah, they do.
But at the end of the day, if the seeds starts growing and there is a cow passing, if there is no one around to chase the cow off, you won't have a forest either, even though you are using drones and all that crap.
Yeah. One of the big projects is Great Green Wall in Africa. Can you explain what this project is about?
Yeah, well, in it started now 13 years ago, I think. It's an effort that is basically run by the African Union. Mm-hmm. And it's initially, it covers a stretch of 8,000 kilometers going from Senegal in the west to Somalia, Ethiopia in the east. And I think it's 19 countries involved. Mm-hmm. 8,000 kilometers long and 100 kilometer wide. And the idea is to plant as much as possible within that stretch, mm-hmm. and to, it's an image, build a green wall against the Sahara.
Yeah.
From the north, and then also from the savannas that still mm-hmm. become drier from the south. Of late, 3 years ago, they decided to mirror that initiative and have a second one in the south. Mm-hmm. Now, the projections are that there is around 200 million hectares, that's a mm-hmm. lot of zeros, yeah, that need to be replanted, all in all.
Yeah.
In the north, it's 100 million. There is now, there's pledges to finance that. And Macron last week told that they have covered like what they think the cost would be, 45% of the total cost, mm-hmm. with what governments and institutions have pledged. But 100 million hectares, if you take that, you plant like 250 trees per hectare.
Yeah.
I leave it to you to calculate the number of trees. And each seed that you plant should be successful. Otherwise, you have to come back. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge effort. But the good news is that from the air, by satellite, especially in Niger, you can now see mm-hmm. that whole areas are much greener now than before.
Yeah.
So it shows that it can be done. Mm-hmm.
And what has to be done for the Great Green Wall to really have a global impact? It's not probably going to be saved by one country, Niger.
Well, there are pockets maybe in other countries as well, but yeah, you have to demultiply the effort. You need to put in a lot of effort, mm-hmm. Manpower, and money to go and sit with the people, but do it. Also here, that's why there is no time to lose. We have lost time by sending in the foresters and sending in the drones and seeing that it was to no effect. Mm-hmm. So please do it now, even though it may be too late. But it will never be too late in those patches where people are convinced. You will quickly see that indeed they will inspire their peers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so I strongly believe in that. So in the power of these small initiatives. But you need a lot of small initiatives to really cover the whole area.
Yeah. Well, as said, the Great Green Wall is a project which is led by the African Union. However, Africa, well, mainly some parts, are not exactly what you would call a politically stable part of the world. How is it with the political support for this project?
Well, Alpha India 2 will answer your question. When I was in Niger, that was my code name because we had to travel undercover and all that because Al-Qaeda et al. Were around. Mm-hmm. In Niger, normally we were operating under a government that is absolutely pro. But of course, yeah, thanks for asking. There is the security issue. I'm going to Senegal now and it's still safe to mm-hmm. go there. But the organization I will be working with there initially was working in Burkina Faso, and they mm-hmm. went out there because of the security issues. But that's something, that we have to address. The political will is something else. Now, like in most cases, the political will goes via the money. Mm-hmm. No money, no go. The other one was right in saying it's all about the economy, stupid. So if there is money, then the political will is easily found. Now, you have a number of governments that are themselves committed. Mm-hmm. In some cases, I know it took some time.
Yeah.
But eventually they see. Now, with reforestation, and there is new schemes around, financial support schemes, where you can prove that your tree will capture CO2 and then you get paid for that.
Yeah.
So that's an incentive. And governments start grasping and seeing that it can indeed be something positive, that by planting trees, they can actually earn money.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it's no longer a taxpayer's problem. It's the free and open market. And that's maybe at the end of the day, that's the best option. I don't believe that the model where you have foreign aid coming in ad infinitum is the solution. No. The private sector should also intervene and come in and finance, even though it would be through these not always very natural mechanisms of CO2 compensation schemes and such. Yeah.
And what is, or more likely, what should be the role of the Faculty of Tropical Agrosciences in this problem, solving this problem?
Yeah, well, first of all, so in my personal case, I did my PhD on drought and salinity stress. Mm-hmm. So I think that we can help in better understanding the problems and then go from there to the solutions. I think that we have within the staff, the personnel here, we have people, we have agroforesters, we have also more social scientists. So we cover the aspect of the socioeconomics of extension. We are now doing a review for FAO in Azerbaijan, where the question was within the range of solutions that you have to that you can use to address climate change. Can you name two on which we will put emphasis? Mm-hmm. So we are collaborating with the government of Azerbaijan. We did a survey. So there was the results. Now we selected two methods. And now it will be a matter of training staff of ministries that are involved, the land ministries, go to local leaders, local groups, train them, and then also from there, hopefully, these methods will be presented to the population. So, and it's a low-cost thing, but we match the know-how, and it's run from this side by the socioeconomists, because there is a human aspect of interviewing, collating the info, and then giving feedback and such. But so, yeah, I think on the technical aspect, on the extension aspect, the socioeconomics, We have a lot of experience and know-how that we can share and take it from there.
If we can try to wrap it up a little bit, after everything we heard, can we still win this race against time, or are we simply going too fast and we will not make it through the next corner?
Well, maybe the good news is that apparently in a number of continents, in a number of areas within continents, the specific case of trees, the reforested surface area is increasing again. The bad news may be that in a number of countries, it's monoculture.
Yeah.
Eucalypts, they grow so fast. So let's plant this. Yeah. I was asked by a bank who wants to compensate its CO2 balance, and they wanted to support a reforestation project in Guatemala, and that would plant eucalypts. I says, you don't do that anymore. No, no, no. So in some cases, there might be the issue of this monoculture approach, but I think slowly by slowly, some of them are learning. And you may say that, of course, having at least trees grow there is a good first step. So, but yeah, the figures, the data tell us that in some areas the situation is improving. Also, climate change is not a global and unique kind of phenomenon. It's not as such that the whole world will become drier or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's with patches. So by thinking locally, by addressing the problem with local solutions, by knowing what those solutions are, and that I feedback that into what we can offer as a faculty, I think that you can find better ways of addressing the problem. And then again, you have to sit with the people and and rest.
Bill Gates also says in his book that we have to get to a zero emissions, otherwise it will not work. Do you agree with this?
I would say stop breathing. You can't do that. I mean, it's. I think that's that's playing with words. I mean, the fact that we are on this planet, we are the biggest factor of disturbance. So the zero sum game will never. Also, it's artificial in this respect. We produce more CO2 than allowed, but then we pay for the CO2 by it and invest it in the south. Like, I mean, we still produce the CO2. There was this nice cartoon. You see this diesel car with a big black cloud behind it. And so you see the image. And then you see the electric car, and in the background you see the electricity plant that bulges out.
Exactly.
I mean, you are just the guy in the car is no longer polluting. At the end of the day, we all pollute. And we will continue. Electricity cars, now you have to take shares in lithium factories, no? And Afghanistan. We all have to go. Our faculty has good links with Afghanistan, so we can go there, yeah? The issue now will be the Taliban hovering over the lithium that is there. And some other of these rare metals that we need for these electric cars. Yeah. And so if it's not an impact on CO2 emission direct, it will be indirect because also mining lithium, it's costly in water. And of course, it will also create
CO2
damage and CO2. So no, I mean, and this idea to produce, to have these machines that will take up CO2, okay, then it's like with plutonium and uranium. Where do you store? Once you have the electricity plant that runs on uranium, you also have what is left over, and it's the same. So we have an impact on the environment. You can't. So no, I don't believe it. So stop breathing.
Well, when preparing for this interview, I obviously downloaded your CV. What surprised me is how rich it is. It actually has 203 pages.
It is.
And I'm wondering, are you looking forward to adding more pages under the theme, the Dean of the Faculty of Tropical Agri-Sciences of CZU?
Oh, in a way, yeah. But I would like to stimulate the people in the faculty to go more international. We are already international, but we can improve. So it will be a matter of teaming up with other research teams, trying to bring in more projects. That will increase, I would say, our standing, know-how and such, but will also allow to increase our visibility to the scientific and to the layman world, I would say. And presumably there will be some lines added here and there.
Well, thank you, Professor, for that you accepted our invitation and that you decided to be a part of the Czech Researchers Night. It has been an enormous pleasure having you here.
Welcome. Thanks.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to this episode. Enjoy the rest of the Researchers' Night and have a good one. Bye.